Assad Assad, the nephew of Omar, Abdul Mujahid Assad, describes his uncle as a very social and caring man. Omar immigrated to the U.S. in 1970s and became a small business owner in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. He and his wife had seven children and many grandchildren, nephews, and nieces. 10 years ago, Omar Assad decided to retire in the village of Jalilia in Ramallah, Palestine, where he was originally from. Assad loved family gatherings and regularly went around to check up on and visit relatives, according to his nephew. He attended a big family gathering on January 11th and was driving back around 20:30 a.m. At this time, members of the Israeli Regime Forces, or IDF, the military force that carries out the occupation of Palestine, were executing an overnight raid in Jalilia. Night raids are a common practice by IDF troops serving to intimidate Palestinians in their most vulnerable state by invading their safest places while they're sleeping. As Assad was driving home through his village, he was reportedly pulled out of his car by IDF troops who aggressively handled him, handcuffed him with plastic zip ties, gagged his mouth, blindfolded him, and forced him to lie on his stomach. The forces then dragged him for about 200 meters and beat him to death. His nephew said there were about 40 forces just watching this handcuffed elderly man, aged 80, be repeatedly hit by armed troops across his entire body. Assad suffered from a subsequent heart attack and was left to die on the ground, unconscious and handcuffed. Assad was buried with bruises across his entire body, said Assad's nephew, adding, "What kind of threat does an 80-year-old man pose to armed Israeli regime troops? He was barely able to walk, and they viciously beat him to death." Omar Assad was an American citizen, a fact that has garnered his story much more media attention than it might have otherwise received. However, this fact shouldn't matter, and in many ways, it doesn't matter. The Zionist regime exhibits a reckless disregard for Palestinian life, and its strongest ally, the United States regime, has responded apathetically to the killing of Omar Assad. On January 13th, the U.S. State Department spokesperson Ned Price said the department got in touch with Assad's family to express their condolences, and that it has also been in touch with Israel to seek clarification about this incident. Somehow, the United States managed to cite the beating and killing of an 80-year-old man, a standard feature of any commentary they provide on the Zionist regime's violent actions. Omar Assad's brutal killing illustrates how Palestinian Americans are unprotected by the United States, whose loyalty is to the Zionist regime's first. Meanwhile, Palestinian, American, and Muslim communities in the U.S. have recognized and organized and mobilized to demand action by the U.S. government for Assad's death. Someone who had community ties in Milwaukee, his family, and the Milwaukee's Islamic community hosted an Aza, or gathering, to offer condolences to the family. His daughter, Hala Ahmed, told the Washington Post, "We want a thorough investigation from the U.S. government and the U.N. because Israel can't investigate their own crimes." Ned Price had previously said they were going to reference Israeli investigations into the incident. American Palestine advocacy organizations like American Muslims for Palestine, Jewish Voice for Peace, and U.S. campaign for Palestinian rights regularly ignite campaigns to lobby for condemnation or action against the killing, exile, imprisonment, and torture of Palestinians within the homeland, who may be stateless or have varied national privileges. 6 Palestinians have been killed this year, 2022. Omar Assad's family deserves accountability and justice. As an enabler of these unlawful killings and the illegal occupation of Palestine, the United States regime must end its complicity and begin holding the Zionist regime accountable for its actions. Communique.
Israel is conducting a targeted campaign against Palestinian prisoners and the organizations defending them. There are currently around 4,600 Palestinians held in Israeli prisons. These figures are from 2020 because Israel refuses to release the real numbers anymore. Around 500 of these Palestinian prisoners are being held in what is called administrative detention. This means they're imprisoned without charge or trial, and they're not even allowed to know why they're in prison because it's secret. At the same time, there are many people fighting for these prisoners' human rights and for their freedom. Palestinian lawyers, human rights activists, NGOs, civil society groups. Israel has attacked these groups for speaking out against its crimes. We know from recent reports that several activists at Palestinian NGOs were spied on after discovering that their mobile phones had been hacked. Their devices were infected with Pegasus, an Israeli cyber weapon. It allows the attacker to turn on the targeted person's microphone, camera, GPS tracking, and view all their messages, photos, and contacts. This spyware, made and sold by an Israeli company, has been used to target journalists, human rights activists, and dissidents all across the world. Israel's actions are not only an affront on the human rights and dignity of Palestinians, which it imprisons without charge or trial, but also an affront on those who defend these prisoners and fight on their behalf. Israel calls itself the only democracy in the Middle East. That's a joke. It couldn't be further from the truth. I'm Richard Medhurst, and this is The Communique. The Israeli occupation in Palestine has many tools that it uses daily to oppress Palestinians. One of the most archaic is something called administrative detention. Administrative detention means you go to prison without even being charged with a crime, and there's no trial. The Israelis use this regularly to throw Palestinians in prison, and even if someone is placed in administrative detention, they're not allowed to know why they're in prison. The Israelis keep a secret file which neither the prisoner nor their lawyer is ever allowed to see. Administrative detention typically lasts 6 months at a time, but can be renewed over and over indefinitely. Every 6 months, the Israelis can just decide to extend the order and keep someone in custody forever if they want. This can typically go on for years. Israel's administrative detention is a violation of the Geneva Convention, because administrative detention by an occupying power is supposed to be used only in extreme cases and on an individual basis. It is not a substitute for a criminal justice system or due process. The Geneva Convention stipulates that in order for administrative detention to be permissible, the person being arrested must pose a significant threat which warrants such detention. Once that threat is gone, the person must be released immediately. Israel doesn't do that. It imprisons people indefinitely and doesn't even tell them why. The way Israel uses administrative detention is not on a case-by-case basis, but as a form of collective punishment. In 2021 alone, the Israelis issued more than 1,500 orders for administrative detention, according to the NGO Adamir. Since 1967, Israel has issued 50,000 administrative orders. This is a clear violation of Article 33 of the Geneva Convention, which prohibits collective punishment. Article 71 of the Geneva Convention says that, quote, no sentence shall be pronounced by the competent courts of the occupying power except after a regular trial. Israel violates this by only placing Palestinians before a military tribunal. There is no regular trial. Article 66 of the Geneva Convention says that prisoners must be sent to a non-political military court located inside the occupied territory. But Israel, again, violates this by sending prisoners to courts located outside the occupied territories. And then another breach. The prisoners are sent to prisons outside the occupied territories, which is in violation of Article 76 under the Geneva Convention. Now, the interesting thing about administrative detention is that it was actually created by the British when Palestine was still a British mandate. In 1945, the Defense Emergency Regulations were enacted, which allowed the British, who occupied Palestine at the time, to establish military courts where civilians could be tried without right of appeal. Sound familiar? British forces could impose curfews, search homes, seize items, any items, and even destroy houses too. The British also gave themselves permission to censor publications and the media. Well, guess what? Israel kept a lot of these so-called laws which were created by the British and imposed on Palestinians. So basically, Palestinians went from living under British colonial rule to living under Zionist colonial rule, with many of the same archaic laws still in place, and a few others amended or repealed. And of course, one of the laws that the Israelis kept from the British was not just the media censor and all the other things, but also the administrative detention, used mainly against Palestinian Arabs, no different than in 1945. Now, joining me to talk more about Palestinian prisoners and administrative detention is Milena Ansari. Milena is an international advocacy officer at Ad-Damir Prisoner Support and Human Rights Association, which is a Palestinian non-governmental organization that advocates for Palestinian political prisoners. Milena, thanks for joining us. I'd like to start out with a report that Ad-Damir released in October. You said that there are around 520 Palestinians who are held in administrative detention without charge, without trial. Could you maybe tell us exactly how administrative detention works and how it's used as a form of collective punishment against Palestinians?
As of the 6th of December, there are 500 Palestinian prisoners under administrative detention without trial or charge, including four Palestinian children under the age of 17. The Israeli occupation relies on administrative detention, which is a procedure taken from the British Mandate Defense Regulations back in 1945. So the basis of this administrative detention goes back to the British Mandate that is still being implemented on the Palestinians. What this administrative detention entails, that the Israeli occupation forces can literally arrest any Palestinian without any charges and without continuing a fair trial for them. And all of this is based on secret material that is most of the time made up by the Israeli Shabak, which is the Israeli security or the intelligence services. What's even more arbitrary regarding this policy is that it does not have a strict limitation or duration. The Israeli occupation can indefinitely hold Palestinians under administrative detention and indefinitely renew their detention without trial or charges. This has created a loophole under the legal system where the Israeli occupation just calls, this person is a threat to the security of Israel, we should detain them for an indefinite time. And we're talking about four Palestinian children under administrative detention that Israel says they impose a risk to the security of the region. What the risk is, nobody knows. Neither the detainee nor the lawyer are allowed to access these secret information, which creates also a psychological torture and ill treatment for the detainees because they are unaware of the charges that are brought against them and they are unaware of the duration of the time they will be spending in Israeli prisons under extremely harsh conditions that do not meet the adequate living standards of a basic human life.
There are six Palestinian prisoners who gained a lot of attention recently because of their hunger strike while in administrative detention. They went on hunger strike for many, many months to protest their captivity under administrative detention. Kayet Fesfouz went on hunger strike for 131 days. That's half a year. And his case drew a lot of attention and support from around the world. He ended his hunger strike on November 22nd, 2021, when the Israeli occupation agreed not to renew his administrative detention. He was released on December 14th, 2021. Miqdad al-Qawasmi ended his hunger strike on November 11th. His hunger strike went on for 113 days. He's set to be released in February 2022. Shadi Abu Akar began his hunger strike on August 25th, 2021. He's been detained by the Israeli occupation, again, without charge or trial, since October 2020. Now, he went on his hunger strike for 69 days, and he suspended it on November 1st, 2021, after the Israeli Prison Service, the IPS, decided to terminate his detention in April 2022. So that's when he'll be released, according to the Prisoners Affairs Committee. Melina, can you tell us a little bit briefly about how these prisoners began their hunger strike and why it's so important? And what is Abdelmir's role in all this? What are you doing to help these prisoners, to support them and everyone who's on hunger strike protesting their administrative detention?
It's important to bear in mind that Palestinian prisoners initiate an ongoing hunger strike as part of the resistance of the Israeli occupation's arbitrary policies. The cases of the six Palestinian prisoners on the hunger strike in the past 2 months has highlighted Israel's systematic reliance on administrative detention to detain Palestinians and maintain control over them.
Now, although these men have achieved a somewhat favorable outcome, you know, they're finally out or soon to be released, it's really important to note the toll that such a prolonged hunger strike takes on someone's health. You know, this was a near-death experience for many of these prisoners, and that's the point to which the Israelis drove them. There was a constant fear that these men would die at any moment. They lost so much weight that they would drop in and out of consciousness, their organs were about to fail, you know, they could barely speak or drink water.
The Israeli prison services and the Israeli occupation in specific, they do not care about their health conditions or what implications of the hunger strike has on their bodies and health and threat to life. They only aim to keep Palestinians in detention. When we're talking about hunger striking detainees reaching 100 and plus days, this is not something to take lightly at all. But we've seen the Israeli military system continuing on approving the renewal of administrative detention and freezing the administrative detention order. They will continue to freeze the order, and then when they see the health condition of the prisoner slightly improving, they will re-establish the administrative detention order. So for them, it's a game that the Israeli system, the judicial system, gives legal cover to and allows. The freezing order, it explicitly means that the prisoner is now the responsibility of the hospital and not the Israeli prison services. And this entails additional ill treatment of the prisoners and detainees.
It's really important to note, however, the game being played here by the Israelis. When we talk about certain prisoners being released, Israel didn't just decide to release them from custody immediately out of compassion or something. You know, Israel still insists that they serve out the entire duration of the detention and only to release them afterwards. So although these men are now free or soon to be free, the Israelis could at any moment rearrest them and throw them back into prison for no reason and keep them there indefinitely. That is the cruelty of administrative detention.
It's important to note that when the military courts freeze the administrative detention, it is in no way does it mean that the detainee is now free or the detainee is not under detention anymore. It only means that the Israeli prison services is not responsible for his life, whatever happens. And the cases of the six Palestinian detainees this time showed us clearly that the Israeli occupation does not care.
There are many Palestinian NGOs and civil society groups who fight on behalf of Palestinian prisoners. On October 25th, 2021, Benny Gantz, the defense minister of the Israeli occupation forces, issued a military order declaring six of these Palestinian civil society groups as terrorist organizations. These six organizations are Al-Damir, Al-Haq, the Bison Center for Research and Development, Defense for Children International in Palestine, Union of Agricultural Work Committees, and the Union of Palestinian Women's Committees. The United Nations called Israel's terrorism designation a, quote, unjustified attack on Palestinian civil society. The UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, Michelle Bachelet, issued a statement on October 26th saying that the concerned organizations were some of the most reputable in Palestine and had worked closely with the UN for years. Bachelet said that, quote, claiming rights before a UN or another international body is not an act of terrorism. Advocating for the rights of women in the occupied Palestinian territory is not terrorism. And providing legal aid to detained Palestinians is not terrorism. Now, one of the NGOs outlawed as a terrorist organization by the Israelis is Al-Damir, where our guest Milena works at. Milena, can you tell us what your reaction is to all this? When Israel designates six Palestinian human rights groups, including Al-Damir, as terrorist organizations, you know, what is the basis for this kind of accusation? Why do you think the Israelis are doing this?
As a clear answer to your question, I would say there is absolutely no basis for this designation in outlawing six prominent civil society organizations that work in different aspects of the Palestinian life. We have, from the six organizations, these organizations work with children, political prisoners, women, farmers and peasants, international reports on the violations of the Israeli occupation, as well as research and documentation. So in a sense, there is absolutely no basis for this. This is part of the Israeli occupation, systematic targeting of civil society organizations to silence them and isolate them from the international community, because they are at the forefront of the organizations that are opposing the systematic and arbitrary policies by the occupation. And we are working to change the paradigm and advocate for the rights of Palestinians on different sectors. And most importantly, we are calling the international community to stand against Israel as an apartheid regime and settler colonialism. So in a way, it is mainly to silence our organization, isolate us from the international arena, and discredit our organizations. Many United Nations organizations and international organizations have condemned this action and called that it is not only attack against the Palestinian community, but the whole international community, which is 100% true, because we do legitimate human rights work that Israel is afraid that the international community will see.
And what are some of the other ways that you've been harassed or intimidated by the occupation forces in your day-to-day operations?
The designation of our organization and further outlawing them in the West Bank is not a single act. Organizations have been under attack for several years in this Israeli campaign to silence us. This includes residency revocation. For example, one of Damir's employees, Salah Hamouri, is now the Israeli Interior Minister. Approved a decision to revoke his Jerusalem permanent residency because he lives in Jerusalem under the allegation of breach of allegiance to the State of Israel. So in addition to the harassments we face, Israel as an occupying power is expecting us as human rights defenders and lawyers to serve loyalty to this occupying power. Other than residency revocation, there are arbitrary arrests without any basis. And this is what we see that happened with the Palestinian health work committees, where it was also outlawed by Israeli military orders. And following the outlaw, several staff members were arbitrarily arrested. For example, the director, which is a 60-year-old Palestinian woman and human rights defender, Shada Audi. Other than arbitrary arrest, there has been also travel bans on the employees There has been intimidation and harassment, threats even of murder to the employees and staff. This is all important to understand that these policies are, their only aim or goal is to intimidate the defenders of human rights and to make sure that they are in a way to deter any voicing of opposition against the apartheid regime.
Speaking of harassment, here's another interesting revelation. At the same time Israel declared these six Palestinian groups terrorist organizations, it turns out that Israeli spyware was used to hack the mobile phones of the activists and employees at these very same Palestinian NGOs. An investigation by frontline defenders revealed that six employees of the targeted Palestinian groups had had their mobile phones hacked. This included at least one person working for Al-Haq, another for Bison Center, and one for Al-Damir. Amnesty International and Citizen Lab, who've done extensive work in exposing Pegasus spyware, corroborated these findings. They discovered traces of Pegasus, which is a piece of spyware, a cyber weapon, developed by an Israeli company called NSO Group. Pegasus allows the attacker to do whatever they want with the victim's phone. They can turn on the microphone, the camera, the GPS, and view all their messages, photos, contacts. Frontline defenders suspect that the timing of this terrorism designation after discovery that the phones had been hacked is not a coincidence. Technically, NSO Group, the company that makes and sells Pegasus, claims that it only sells Pegasus to government agencies who are trying to solve serious crimes or deal with counterterrorism. So by declaring these NGOs as terrorists, is the Israeli occupation government trying to somehow justify using Pegasus? Nevertheless, one thing is crystal clear. Israel is doing everything it can, from spying to outlawing these NGOs and Palestinian civil society groups, in order to stop them from exposing Israel's human rights abuses and crimes against Palestinians.
Communique is a program in which Richard Medhurst, the independent journalist and political commentator, gives his views of controversial issues of our time and interviews famous politicians and personalities. This program is broadcast every Sunday by IRIB English Radio.
To give you a better understanding of how cruel administrative detention is, many people have had their detention renewed on the way out of prison. So they would be at the prison gate, ready to leave, ready to go home, thinking that they're free and they can see their family, and then the Israelis tell them that they have to go back into prison again for 6 months. Some people have even been stopped outside the prison, already on the way home. They get pulled over at a checkpoint and told that their administrative detention has been renewed and they must go back to prison. Administrative detention is obviously not just a barbaric and cruel form of punishment, but the toll that it takes on the prisoners and their families, emotionally, psychologically, is tremendous. Someone might be arrested by the Israeli occupation forces and then jailed, and then their parents, their siblings, their partner have all been to prison. It seems that almost every family has had someone imprisoned by the Israeli occupation. Israel calls itself the only democracy in the Middle East. Israel isn't a democracy at all. How can you be a democracy when you randomly throw people in prison without telling them why they're in prison, and then you refuse to charge them or try them? What kind of a legal process is that? That's not even a kangaroo court. It's just barbaric. How is that any different from what the United States does to people in Guantanamo Bay, where it imprisons men for years without ever charging them or convicting them of a crime? These are the kinds of practices that the Americans and Israelis accuse other countries of doing. They accuse the Arabs, the Iranians, the Russians of doing this, but they themselves are complicit in this behavior. The Israelis and Americans act like they're civilized and democratic and they're better than everyone else, as if everyone else comes from the jungle and just doesn't get it. But look at their behavior. Look at what Israel and the United States do, and you will find a lot of hypocrisy and a lot of authoritarianism. Administrative detention is a cruel, barbaric practice. It doesn't just hurt the prisoner, it hurts their family as well. There's no such thing as Israeli justice. There is no justice for Palestinians. There is only a brutal military occupation that exists to protect a racist settler colony that steals land from Palestinians and kills them or imprisons them when they try to resist. administrative detention is a leftover colonial practice from the British Empire. How fitting that the Israelis kept it to use it against Palestinians. It's just further proof that Israel is a British creation. Palestinians essentially went from living under British colonial rule to living under Zionist colonial rule, with many of the same archaic laws still in place. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Richard Medhurst, and this is The Communique.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
The damage done by rampant overproduction of virgin plastics and their lifestyle is irreversible. This is a threat to human civilization and the planet's basic ability to maintain a habitable environment. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Kenny Stancil, journalist. This article is published under the heading Global Plastic Pollution is a Deadly Ticking Clock, report says. Stay tuned for more. There is a deadly ticking clock counting swiftly down. So says Tom Gamage, an ocean campaigner at the Environmental Investigation Agency, EIA, a United Kingdom-based group whose new report warns that only a muscular global treaty can turn the tide against the life-threatening crisis of plastic pollution. Published recently, Connecting the Dots, Plastic Pollution and the Planetary Emergency assembles the latest scientific data to show how the unprecedented accumulation of toxic plastic particles directly undermines our health, drives biodiversity loss, exacerbates climate change, and risks generating large-scale harmful environmental changes. Released in the wake of a landmark United Nations study that documented how plastic pollution in aquatic ecosystems has skyrocketed in recent years and is projected to more than double this decade and nearly triple by 2040 if governments fail to prevent fossil fuel and petrochemical campaigns from expanding the production of single-use plastics, EIA's report seeks to inform discussions at next month's UN Environmental Assembly in Nairobi, Kenya, where member states will have a chance to commit to drastically reducing waste. This tidal wave of pollution continues unchecked, Gamage said recently in a statement, the anticipated 646 million tons of plastics in the seas by 2040 could exceed the collective weight of all fish in the ocean. Gamage said the visible nature of plastic pollution has generated huge public concern, but the vast majority of plastic pollution impacts are invisible. According to the report, around 92% of all plastic at the ocean surface is microplastic that have either broken down from larger debris or were intentionally created that way. Our oceans truly are turning into a plastic soup. Up to 51 trillion plastic fragments exist in surface waters alone. It is now globally pervasive. Plastic is found in the deepest parts of the ocean, on the highest mountain peaks, in human organs, and on remote and uninhabited islands. Some fragments are so microscopic that we are still developing the analytical techniques needed to even detect them. Gamage added that the damage done by rampant overproduction of virgin plastics and their lifestyle is irreversible. This is a threat to human civilization and the planet's basic ability to maintain a habitable environment. From the beginning of the manufacturing process to end of life, where just 9% of plastic waste is recycled, 12% is incinerated, and 79% is thrown away. Plastics generate physical and chemical pollution that degrades ecosystems. Plastic waste is now recognized as a possible disease vector, and it plays an important role in spreading invasive species and antibiotic-resistant genes around the globe. All of this adversely affects food webs, leads to the destruction of biodiversity, and contributes to the disruption of Earth system processes that sustain life. Moreover, the toxic substances used to create plastic products consumed when humans ingest or inhale contaminated food, water, or air have been linked to cancer and other negative changes to hormonal, developmental, and reproductive systems. According to the report, the overriding evidence also suggests that these chemicals are connected to the recent sharp increase of non-communicable diseases in humans. This is recognized by calls for plastic waste to be classified as hazardous, and in a consensus statement published by 33 scientists in 2020, which urged policymakers to reduce exposure to harmful chemicals present in food packaging. In addition, the fossil fuel-based production of plastic increases the emission of heat-trapping greenhouse gases, intensifying the climate emergency and jeopardizing the world's ability to limit global temperature rise to 1.5 degrees Celsius. The report explains in 2015 the total estimated lifestyle emissions from plastics were 1.78 billion tons of carbon dioxide equivalent CO2e. For context, if the whole plastics life cycle were a country, it would be the fifth largest emitter of greenhouse gases in the world. By 2050, the life cycle emissions of plastic are predicted to be 6.5 GT CO2e per year, cumulatively taking up 15% of the entire remaining carbon budget. Another new study by researchers at the Stockholm Resilience Center found that chemical pollution on Earth has crossed a planetary boundary, with the worldwide boom in plastic production contributing significantly to the problem. As EIA put it, plastic pollution poses a direct threat to the very limits of what our planet can manage. On top of the indirectly driving humanity closer to the planetary boundaries for climate change and biodiversity loss, the report states, it is clear that the rapid accumulation of plastic, not just in the ocean, but in all environments, poses a direct threat to planetary boundaries. If a disruptive effect to the Earth system is not already happening, then it soon will without decisive action. Despite being the world's biggest per capita plastic polluters, the United States and the UK have so far refused to join an international treaty to curb the amount of plastic waste destined for landfills and habitats, though both countries are reportedly now open to the idea.
Welcome back. The first part of the show went to Israel's Negev desert to reveal Dimona's hidden secrets. A Dimona's core reactor is made of cement-coated metal. The fuel rods are inserted into the core where nuclear fusion takes place. Now, over the years, core absorbs tremendous amounts of heat and radiation, which slowly cause a degeneration of its materials. The Dimona core, which was put into action back in 1963, was intended to be operational for up to 40 years, but it's exceeded the intended time frame by over a decade now. In fact, Israel is least threatened by the Dimona, having its population living in the north far from the reactor. 95% of the wind direction in Palestine is northwesterly, away from the Israeli localities, but towards Jordan and Palestine. Mordechai Benunu, the Israeli nuclear scientist and whistleblower, has long stated in interviews that Dimona's chimneys do not operate unless the wind blows in the direction of Jordan, and that Jordan should test residents in areas just across the border from the Dimona to be sure they've not already been exposed to radiation.
Israeli nuclear program is surrounded by a novel atmosphere. Arnon Milchan is a famous Hollywood producer behind films like Pretty Woman, Club of Fighters, or L.A. Confidential. He was also good friends with Benjamin Netanyahu. Recently, he revealed his double life. During all these years, he worked as a Mossad agent, helping Israel to buy technology needed to make nuclear weapons. Under a Hollywood producer cover, he was actually a kind of godfather of Israel's nuclear program. But there is no story like that of Mordechai Vananus. Vananu was a nuclear technician in Dimona till 1985. Before quitting, he snapped two rolls of film at the top-secret nuclear plant. The world was stunned when the Sunday Times published Vananu's story and photos, exposing for the first time the secrets of Israel's nuclear arsenal in October 1986. But Israeli intelligence found Mordechai Vananu, and they waited for the right moment to strike. Sent a woman agent to seduce Mordechai Vananu in London and convince him to travel with her to Rome. Vananu was vulnerable and afraid and fell for Mossad's honey trap. The article was published on October the 5th, 1986. Vananu had vanished. His kidnap, an illegal act on foreign soil, was kept secret. Later, when Vananu appeared for a secret court session in Jerusalem al-Quds, he found a way to reveal what had happened to him since he left London. Writing on his hand, Vananu M was hijacked in Rome. Vananu's trial was held in secret. He was found guilty of treason and espionage and sentenced to 18 years in jail, 11 of them in solitary confinement. The woman that seduced Vananu was Cheryl Ben-Dior. After she completed her mission, she disappeared back into her secret world. Today, she lives back in Orlando, USA, with her husband and two daughters, running a real estate business. Vananu's revelations confirmed suspicions and showed a weapons program bigger and more advanced than anyone had previously thought. Mordechai Vananu was released in 2004, but he is not a free man. Israeli borders are now his prison. His passport was confiscated and he cannot contact foreigners.
This Jewish state have 200 atomic weapons, have hydrogen bomb, atomic weapons, neutron bomb, And they are not able to say they have the bomb. They are not able to destroy anyone. They are not able to use the bomb. Instead, they arrest Banu Mordechai.
Dimona's symbol, the only building seen from far away. A 20 meters high nuclear reactor dome. In 1986, Vanunu took us inside. A heavy water reactor built in the 50s with France and Norway's help. With a capacity of 24 megawatts. Thanks to Vanunu, we learned that this reactor capacity is three or possibly even five times larger than assumed. This reactor produces 40 kilograms of plutonium a year, enough to build 10 to 12 atomic bombs. Adjacent to the reactor is Institute Number 3. Here, the fuel rods powering the reactor are produced, together with lithium-6, another ingredient of the bomb. Institute Number 5. Here, the fuel rods are coated with the aluminium. Institute Number 6 is the power station of the compound. The lab is in Institute Number 8, and inside is another secret revealed by Mordechai Vanunu. This is where Israel produces enriched uranium. Like plutonium, it's conserved as fissionable material for the bomb. The uranium is produced through gas centrifuges. Enriched uranium is also produced in Institute Number 9 using laser, a unique Israeli patent. Institute Number 10 produces the depleted uranium, an important component in the production of armor-piercing shells. Institute Number 4 handles the radiation waste prior to it being disposed. And long two-story building with no windows is Dimona's biggest secret. Institute Number 2. Beneath the two innocent-looking floors, hidden underground are six additional floors. It was Vanunu who showed the world what no satellite could see. Here, Israel set up a plutonium separation facility with one goal, the manufacturing of atomic bombs. In the 60s, American inspectors visited the first floor. They saw the restaurants and the offices. A special wall was constructed, hiding the elevators leading to the underground levels. Back outside, trucks bring in the processed uranium rods. Through the large doors, a crane grasps the rods and lowers them to the big workspace four floors below. The rods are dipped in nitrous acid tanks, cooked for about 30 hours, and then a system of pipes draws the water containing the uranium and plutonium. Through a chemical process, the materials are separated and then baked in an oven, producing a small 130-gram plutonium ball, 1.7 kilograms a week, 4 kilograms, and it's a bomb. Just as shot by Vanunu, the process can be viewed from level 2. A balcony was built for distinguished guests, nicknamed Golda's Balcony. And that's the control room as shot by Vanunu. Only 150 employees are authorized to enter it. Visits are limited to the Prime Minister, the Ministry of Military Affairs, and a small group of confidants. Equipped with a hidden camera, Vanunu walked about Institute Number 2 and took pictures of the different sections. Not only plutonium is produced here. At level number 4, Vanunu revealed the production of tritium used in the production of thermonuclear bombs, which are more powerful than ordinary atomic bombs. Two other essential materials for the bomb are produced here, lithium and deuterium. All these ingredients are taken to level 5, to unit MD2, the metal department, where they are assembled into a bomb. One level down is a recreation room where Vanunu shot what experts identified as a model of an Israeli thermonuclear bomb. 10 times more powerful than the bomb dropped on Hiroshima. Experts that analyzed Vanunu's testimony determined that by the 80s, Israel had produced 100 to 200 atomic bombs. This ranks Israel as the sixth or even fifth nuclear power in the world. From Amman, we travel to southern Jordan. cancer rates were recorded in all the southern Jordanian governorates, which confirms the possible direction of nuclear dust that might be leaking from Dimona. Tips we received claim that in Jordan there are hundreds of cases of cancer and other diseases, all of them in the regions near the border with Israel. From Talifar to Dimona, it is about 30 kilometers, and winds or water knows no borders. In almost every house in this region, we can find the same story: diseases and death. Dimona is a word that everybody knows around here. But in Jordan, like in Israel, Dimona and its deadly consequences are a taboo. Saleh is a tour guide and an activist. For years, he is trying to uncover what is happening to the people around the Tafila region. Our next stop is in Tafila. Here, the average manifestation of cancer is higher than the other Jordanian governorates and surrounding Arab countries. Going to visit the governor's office, where we are going to meet the mayor and the governor of the region. It's a surprise what we are going to hear. People around Tafila region are dying from cancer in high numbers. Doctors link the cases to Dimona contamination. But officially, nobody can say it, not even the ones that are dying. Dana is an amazing natural treasure in Jordan, too close to Dimona. Bassem Saudi was born here, in this land, a step away from Dimona nuclear plant. He knows that his people are dying silently and wants answers that never come. Is Dimona nuclear plant poisoning its Arab neighbors? While we were filming with Bassem Saudi, some guards at the Dana Natural Reserve approach us. They want to break their silence. They also have a story to tell about how Dimona is killing their families. We are back in Palestine to visit some villages south of Al-Khalil, very close to the Negev Desert and Dimona. Here, the cancer rates are growing in alarming numbers. The causes are not more than rumors. Nuclear radioactive leakage from Dimona and nuclear waste dumps in the area, or even both. We try to find a clear answer to these rumors in Berlin with Xanthe Hall.
200 cubic meters a year were produced in Dimona, and it's been running for more than 40 years. We can estimate about 8,000 cubic meters of radioactive waste have been, that's the bottom line, have been produced. And so try and imagine what that is. It's maybe, in a picture, 50,000 standard barrels of oil would be about 8,000 cubic meters. We also don't know where they bury this waste. They say that it's not far from the reactor, and the main problem that we're looking at here is what state are these stainless steel containers in? Are they corroded? Will they be leaking? Are they seeping into the ground, into the water sources? Are we seeing pollution of the environment, and therefore of people's health? I mean, I don't know exactly the geography of the area, but there it's chalk, and I imagine that the whole area is probably also chalk. And that is not a good area to be deposing any kind of waste. And they saw that with this toxic waste dump, because there was leakages and serious health problems were discovered. So I would imagine that it would be similar in the area around Dimona, because it's not far away. And also whether it gets into the water or not, because once it gets into the water, then it transports much further into other areas and people can drink it that are quite far away. So then we're talking about basically that there would be cancers later on, or leukemia, and in particularly the children would be badly affected, because children and especially women are more susceptible to radiation. The effects on them are much greater than grown men, for instance. I would say that those are the ones that we have found, definitely in the studies that have been done around nuclear installations in Germany, that the main problem was childhood cancer. And in the areas surrounding plutonium reprocessing plants like Sellafield, in the UK, the main problem was leukemia.
The radioactivity has a tremendous power that can penetrate the human gene, affecting generation after generation. Jamal is a Palestinian policeman. He was arrested after the Second Intifada and spent 13 years in jail. Now he is free, but living a new hell. His daughter has cancer. At the age of 9, she was diagnosed with leukemia. Nothing in the medical report says this Palestinian girl is a direct victim of Dimona. But she comes from an area that counts 70% of cancer cases among the Palestinian population. Israel is probably the 6th or even 5th nuclear power in the world. While others should open the doors of their nuclear programs for inspections, Israel is a special case, producing nuclear weapons since the 60s without any control. Meanwhile, the cancer cases and other diseases are spreading across Israel, Palestine, and neighboring Arab countries. The victims die without knowing what or who is killing them.
Well, even if Dimona's deadly weapons of mass destruction are never used, still, the reactor has been silently killing masses of defenseless citizens throughout the decades, and it continues doing so. And by continuing to maintain and operate the Dimona reactor, Israel is committing a crime against humanity that will be added to the atrocities that it's perpetrated throughout its history. And that's it for this week, everyone. Thank you for joining us next time for another documentary right here. Until another episode of Aperture, it's goodbye.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/ParsTodayEN. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/ParsTodayEnglish.